This is News in No Time, Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, is there a quota for the Supreme Court? And WorldCom's founder gets 25 years. From NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., Julianne Malvo, economist and co-author of Unfinished Business, a Democrat and a Republican take on the top 10 issues women face. Also joining us from D.C., Jeffrey Johnson, host and producer of the Cousin Jeff Chronicles on BET. And joining me here in our New York studios, Pedro Noguera, professor at New York University. And this is his maiden voyage with us today. We welcome you. And we rushed him in here and threw him in the seat. So we appreciate his time. Let's talk a little bit about the idea of this appointment that the president has been talking about this week and so much a buzz, quite frankly, across the nation. Julianne Malvo, as we look at the Supreme Court, one can argue for years there has been this notion, this unsaid notion of a quota. There seems to be one black chair, women had two seats, and now there seems to be this want and push for a seat for a Latino. A, is this a good idea? And B, if not, shouldn't there be a demand from the people, if you will, for more diversity on this august body?
Well, I don't know that there really has been a quota. If there was a one-woman thing, I mean, clearly Clinton broke it with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Sandra Day O'Connor has talked about how comforting it was to have a second woman. So I don't see why you couldn't have two African-Americans or two Latinos, no Asian justice. I prefer to look at it in terms of, A, going for diversity, but B, looking at the best justices for the position. It looks like Mr. Bush is going to have two, not one appointment. As you know, Judge Rehnquist was rushed to the hospital yesterday. And so there, you know, he has not said he'll resign, but his health is very precarious. And so I'm hoping that we do get a second woman, but also that we get some good justices who don't have ideological litmus tests that'll make it difficult for those of us who care about our rights, civil rights, women's rights, children's rights, to see a court turning the clock back. Mm-hmm.
Pedro?
Yeah, I think those who wanted to see a seat designated for a particular group, like a black seat when Justice Marshall left the court, really came to regret that when Clarence Thomas was appointed. And so while I think I would, like many others, like to see a Latino on the court, the idea that just any Latino will do, I don't think anybody would go with that. It really is about the person, their background, what they bring to the court. Diversity is important, but not the expense of a justice who is going to really reflect the broad needs of the society.
I'm going to stick, Jeff, with the quota thought here in the sense of when Thurgood Marshall was replaced. All of us knew, all of us understood that it was going to probably be an African-American who took that seat. It was going to be hard-pressed not to give an African-American that seat. So I do believe there is a sense, whether it be silent or not, of quota on this court. Jeff, you with us?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm getting a little difficult feedback in my earpiece here. If I'm getting your question correctly and following the resignation of Thurgood Marshall, I think there was a great deal of expectation, and I think that expectation was thoroughly disappointed as we saw Clarence Thomas. And so I think the real issue here, as my colleagues have already stated, is less what does this person look like and more what do they stand for? What has their record been? What are the decisions that they've made? What are the issues that they stand on? And even more importantly, I think as we've heard over and over again, as we've started to deal with this whole fight of the Supreme Court, is will these be justices that interpret the law and not try to recreate the law? And I think that that's what all of us need to be concerned with as we begin to see not only the names of these nominees, but more importantly, the confirmation hearings that begin to take place within the Senate.
Right, and, you know, when Thurgood Marshall learned that Clarence Thomas would be his replacement, he noted that a black snake was as bad as a white snake. Those were Thurgood Marshall's words. We might want to keep those in mind.
Right, and that may be the case, but I'm looking at it from the other end. I'm looking at it from the people who appoint these men and women to these seats, and one has to take into account they are looking at political tea leaves, and in doing so, they are looking at color in that instance. All right, let's turn our attention to the Army, and the United States has been long talked about in terms of being in a quagmire militarily, and now a new study conducted by the military suggests that the U.S. Army in particular is so strained that the United States will soon, and this justices, quote, need to decide what military capabilities the Army should have and what risks may be prudent to assume based on their participation in a number of areas, principally Afghanistan and Iraq. Pedro, when we look at this situation, clearly something that Donald Rumsfeld has tried to keep under the radar, but it is a huge problem.
Huge problem. Right now, we have a situation where the U.S. is occupied both in Iraq and Afghanistan, so we are in effect fighting two wars on two different fronts at a time when the United States has declared a war on terrorism, which theoretically is a war that is borderless, a war that really has no end and doesn't have a clear state as an enemy. It's clear that you need to have a different strategy with respect to the military and how that military is deployed under these circumstances than we've had in the past. And it's not clear that the Defense Department or this administration has devised such a strategy.
Julianne, you've heard Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld consistently suggest that the Army and the military is doing okay, that they're not stretched too thin. When you see this, does this speak at all to what the United States, the public, is hearing yet again from this administration?
Well, the administration has not been candid. Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton serves on the Senate Armed Services Committee, first New Yorker to do so. And she spoke to a group yesterday and talked about some of the challenges and their attempt to raise the size of the Army. Because you have situations, Ed, where two family members are married and they have children. The grandparents have to take the children because both parents are deployed in different places, especially if they're in one of the special branches of the Army, special ops, or something like that. You have situations where people were in the reserves, signed up for 6 months, and it's going on 2 years, and their spouses, who may have been non-working spouses, don't know how to keep the money together. So you really are placing a lot of pressure on people whose engagement they assumed was relatively limited. And the only way to spread that burden around is to increase the size of the Army. So Rumsfeld has been very disingenuous in his presentation, because even as they're doing this, the backstory is they're offering people $40,000, up to $40,000, to join branches of the military because we don't have enough people there. So this study simply confirms what people in the military and people in the inside have been saying, even as our Secretary of Defense has been spinning just a different story.
Jeff? I think we also have to look at the fact that even how some of these enlisted men and women are being utilized, and the fact that reservists have been used over this last campaign in ways that reservists were never intended to be utilized. And so that, again, just speaks to this continued notion that our armed services are stretched too thin. But I think there's some other pervasive issues as well, which is even in, as you begin to deal with the issue of bringing in new people and recruiting, there's some not only disingenuous methods that this administration is getting ready to use, but there is a lack of desire to ensure that those that enlist in the armed services are being paid at the level to be able to take care of their families. Many of you know that there's a provision in the No Child Left Behind Act that is allowing the armed services access to the names of 16, 17, and 18-year-olds in the public schools as an opportunity to recruit unbeknownst to them. And so even as we begin to see the armed services and try to increase its numbers, there continues to be a disingenuous tone as it even relates to recruitment.
All right, let's move our attention to something that the world, quite frankly, was sitting and watching, and that was Discovery's launch, which would have been the first since the disaster of the Columbia explosion 2.5 years ago. And once again, it had to be scrapped. Question about a faulty fuel tank sensor. Jeff, one of the questions that remains now, as so much money is being spent on these operations, is whether this, quite frankly, is good money spent, whether we are getting all of what we had been promised so many years ago with a space exploration.
Well, clearly, I think that there's been an evolution of what space exploration means. And I don't know if whether we're talking about Ronald Reagan and Star Wars and how that has transformed and all the technology that has changed, if we've really done an honest assessment of what we want a modern-day space program to look like. And my concern is that we continue to put hundreds of millions of dollars into a plan that doesn't seem to have been properly assessed for what makes sense. What is now the litmus for what makes a successful space program, and has NASA been able to evolve to a place where that makes sense? I mean, because when it comes down to it, if you're talking to somebody like me, who's a grassroots activist, and you juxtapose the amount of money that we're spending on space programs that is in many cases unsuccessful with some of the other needs that we have in our community, you're forced to say we really need to take another look at this and be a little bit more responsible.
Julianne, if you speak to someone like me in their mid-40s, you remember that when you were in elementary school, so much was promised, so much talked about space colonies, what we'd be doing by now. You don't see that necessarily, and I'm curious what your thought is.
Well, I agree with Jeff about the hundreds of millions, really billions of dollars that we've used in the space thing. I remember writing a column back in the 80s about how much money we were throwing into space, and at that time, remember having an exchange with someone from NASA who talked about some of the micro things in terms of fuel usage and Velcro, some of these things that from space had sort of seeped into our everyday life. But then you have to ask, I mean, how many hundred millions of dollars is Velcro really worth? NASA has not been transparent in terms of what's going on. We don't have a future plan, and we can't put our hands around it. And also the disaster, the Columbia disaster, really does raise questions about use of life. I think the whole thing needs to be retooled, but I also think there needs to be a dialogue. The problem, Ed, is that the American people, we've dumbed down so much of what we do that we aren't even having the kind of conversations we need to have about Iraq, about our budget. You know, we did the last segment talking about the military, but without talking about the budgetary implications. We add that with this and look to the future. We're throwing money into space, and our grandchildren are going to pay for it in terms of future costs.
Pedro.
Yeah, I would just add that early on, when we first were exploring space, the largest rationale given was that space flight was a part of some kind of competition with the Russians, and our national mm-hmm. prestige was attached to getting into space mm-hmm. and beating the Russians on the moon. It's not clear at all now what the rationale is, and the administration hasn't done a good job in explaining why we should be investing this kind of money in space exploration. I think an argument could be made that it's worth it to continue to be involved in this, in space in these ways, but I don't think the administration's done that. And given the other needs that we have as a nation and the other needs that the world has, I'm not sure if this is the best use of public funds.
Julianne, let me turn to you for our last topic of the day, and that's Bernie Ebbers, a founder and former chief executive of WorldCom, was sentenced yesterday 25 years in prison for his role in the $11 billion accounting fraud that brought down that huge company in 2002. Were you, first of all, at all surprised?
I was surprised at the length of the sentence. I was not surprised that he was sentenced. 25 years for a 62-year-old man essentially is a life sentence. If you contrast this to a decade or so ago when Michael Milken got 10 years, served about 2.5, Ebbers has been heavily fined. But it's a different era. I mean, the business page these days looks like, you know, the crime blotter. Corporate CEOs obviously take coaching in how to do a perp walk these days. It's literally the level of fraud is so pervasive. The public has lost patience with it. Judges have lost patience with it. Tens of thousands of people have been hurt by the actions of people like Ebbers and, frankly, also Scrushy in Alabama, so many others. Some are able to duck it. Some get sentenced lightly. But I think even the fact that Martha Stewart got those 10 months for a minor lie really speaks to the way that people are saying no to corporate chicanery. And so, you know, 25 years is a tough sentence. He seems to think he has grounds for appeal, but with good behavior, it's 20. He'll be 80 years old when he gets out. But how many people lost their pensions? And I think the fact that one of the public representatives spoke in the sentencing phase certainly influenced the judge.
Yeah, it's interesting, Pedro, to juxtapose, and albeit said up front, that each case is different, to see what Martha Stewart got versus what Scrushy got in Birmingham, and some suggest because he was playing on home field, he got the advantage there, and what Bernie Ebbers was ultimately sentenced to.
Yeah, I think that most of us are still waiting to see what's going to happen to Enron. I think many mm-hmm. of us are encouraged by seeing Ebbers be convicted and receive a severe sentence, because for too long there's been a sense that if you commit white-collar crimes, even when they involve large sums of money, that you'll be treated very differently than if you rob a local grocery store. But the fact is that Enron is the biggest culprit, and their ties to this administration, I think, make that case even more important. And so the real question is, does the conviction of Evers send a signal that Ken Lay and company are really in for it?
Hey, Jeff, do you believe when you take a look at HealthSouth, when you take a look at WorldCom, when you take a look at Enron, and we can go on, that the business world, quite frankly, in the United States has got it, and that, and this is the truth that isn't told. If you look for the wizard behind the curtain, these aren't the only three companies that have played funny with the books.
Well, clearly, I mean, I think what's happening is we're beginning to see that for years there has been a mode of operation that where accountability just didn't take place. I mean, clearly these CEOs that have been brought to light have been operating very similarly. And so I think that there's just been a very pervasive mode of operation within corporate America that has said in many cases that you will never be held accountable for your misdoings. And I think that in many cases, we're really beginning to see, I think many activists over and over again talked about how the courts and the justice system would crack down on poor people, whether it was for drugs or whether it was for violent crime, but we didn't see the same kind of enforcement for white-collar criminals. And I think the tide is beginning to turn. I think that not only are we seeing that people are understanding the real implications of how many lives are affected by corporate indiscretion and unethical behavior at the CEO level, but we're beginning to see that those that do these crimes are not going to be able to get off anymore. So to really answer your question, no, I don't think that these are the only folks. I think that there has just been an undercurrent of unethical behavior that's been a mode of operation for decades, and that now the country is saying to its CEOs, to its corporations, that no longer can our shareholders and our communities be forced to reap all of these issues and no one be held accountable.
All right, Julianne Melveaux, Jeff Johnson. I got to stop you there, Julianne.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we're up against that clock. Julianne Melveaux, Jeff Johnson, and Pedro Noguera. And Pedro, again, welcome. Thanks for joining us. Greatly appreciate it. And I thank all of you.